Phil Carter is Senior Fellow and Director of the Military Veterans and Society Program at the Center for a New American Security. And Phil was a panelist on a conversation about healthcare technology as a national security asset and improving outcomes. Phil, you're one of the experts, not just in Washington, but around the country on healthcare technology as it pertains to veterans, being one yourself. What was your main takeaway from this event that your colleague Ben Fitzgerald moderated about healthcare technology as a national security asset? Thanks for being on, Phil.
You're welcome. And I think there are a couple of takeaways. One is that everything in the defense and veteran space is easier said than done. Implementation and everything about the actual hard work of these agencies takes time, and there's a lot of friction. And so even when a senior leader like Dr. Karen Geis, the number two person in DOD's health affairs office, wants to do something, it may take months or years to get done and an awful lot of effort. And the second thing is that there's a lot of innovation taking place, and especially a lot focused on the warfighter. But where the real opportunity lies is to leverage this vast amount of data that DOD collects and use it to really improve outcomes, to think about how DOD can, say, better provide wellness support to military family members and retirees, or better provide preventative care. And that's the real opportunity. And I think DOD has just scratched the surface in making that a reality.
Do you come away from this event with more confidence after hearing from Dr. Geis about what DOD's strategy is, or that they have one? Because there was a sense for a long time that they kind of knew they had some opportunities they could leverage, but they weren't exactly sure how they were going to go about doing that.
I think the department has a strategy for how it's going to operate on a day-to-day basis. And we can question whether or not that's a strategy. What I'm not sure they have is a long-term vision that intersects with where technology is going, and especially where the private sector is moving with healthcare technology and the delivery of healthcare and new structures for doing so, whether it's the huge shift away from hospitals to outpatient clinics, or the huge shift into things like telemedicine and the use of electronic communications in healthcare. I'm not sure the DOD really sees where it wants to be or should be 10 or 15 or 20 years down the line.
One thing I think we can also be sure of is that there's right now very little or no intersection with the Department of Veterans Affairs on sharing healthcare information, at least, and the technology that may be the case as well. And it strikes me that that's not likely to change anytime soon. Do you see anything on the horizon that causes you to be more optimistic?
Right. If only it was only the Potomac River that separated these two agencies. Sometimes it's more like the Pacific. The big procurement that the Defense Department has underway for a health record system could change this. The various providers that are jostling for this procurement all have some solutions that will answer the need for better interoperability and sharing of information. But again, the challenge is implementation and making that happen and making it work with the systems the VA has, which are not necessarily connected to anything that the DOD will buy, is going to be hard. It's going to take continued leadership, and this is going to go far into the next administration. This could even go into the administration after next, based on the life cycle of some of these procurements.
Your point is well taken, Phil, because the Department of Veterans Affairs' stated position historically has been that they don't want an interoperable solution. They simply want the Department of Defense to adopt VISTA, and thereby everything's interoperable because it's the same system. And the Defense Department has had any number of opportunities to do that, including this most recent procurement that you talked about, and has decided not to do it and has decided to go in a totally different direction. They don't preclude the possibility that they could adopt VISTA, but again, they could have done it a number of times before and have chosen not to. And I guess that's why people who are watching this seem to say they don't see this getting better anytime soon. And in fact, the timelines that you just described are the timelines that I'm starting to hear, which, if we're talking about another administration after the next one, that's a 10, maybe 15, maybe 20-year time cycle.
That's right. And, one of the things that we don't know right now is, where does technology go in the interim? It could be that some one of these health information exchanges around the country or the next startup that hasn't been founded actually figures out a better way to do this and renders both of the agencies' approaches completely obsolete. I think the departments, both DOD and VA, probably need to visualize that future and some other alternate futures a little bit better. You know, it's clear they're both going down their respective parallel paths that procure systems that don't necessarily talk well together, but it's entirely possible that at some point in the future there will be a better way to do business, and I do hope the agencies pursue that when it becomes available.
Phil Carter of the Center for a New American Security. You can read more about the event he participated in on the future of healthcare technology as a national security asset at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. That is one asset of the men and women who serve in the military, Phil, and we'll learn more about some of the other assets, benefits, compensation, and so on that they have and what's important to them when the Military Compensation and Retirement Modernization Commission reports out on Thursday. You and your colleague Kate Kidder are preparing a primer on the concept of modernizing retirement and compensation. What are the main points that you think we should be paying attention to when we read what the commission presents on Thursday?
So our analysis looked at the long-term trend over the last 25 years of military compensation, which has generally been up. But one of the interesting things we found is the growth of military compensation elements that are not just base pay. So base allowance for housing, subsistence, the personnel compensation of military reservists who are out on active duty. It's a much more complex mixture than simply saying we should increase or decrease base pay or tie that to inflation. So I think looking in the commission's report for some of that complexity and a better sense of which levers are the impactful ones to pull will be important.
I have been struck throughout the conversation about military compensation, even going back to before the Comp Commission started its work or was even thought of on Capitol Hill, by the fact that not many people seem to be emphasizing what you and Kate are emphasizing in the work that you did here, and that is the AVF. You use that acronym over and over again, the all-volunteer force, and thinking about the fact that if the compensation package doesn't fit them well, these men and women can decide after their term is up to just walk away.
That's right. This is a critical element of sustaining and improving the AVF, but we can't just think about compensation reform in a vacuum. Compensation reform, compensation adjustments have to be considered as part of a total talent management package. Today's force is increasingly made up of millennials and post-millennials for whom cash compensation is only one part of the social contract. It's an important part. It's what enables them to support their families. But there are other things, too, that the services have to consider. Education and training, retention, moving people around, selection and promotion authorities. And so what we need to see coming out of the services is a better strategy for managing all of these pieces. And merely tinkering on the margins with compensation may help make some ends meet, but it's not going to answer the broader call for how we sustain the AVF in the decades to come.
You point out something here that is not peculiar to the Department of Defense, but I think is important to note in the context of DOD. You write, the DOD retiree population now exceeds the size of the active military and will soon exceed the size of the active and reserve force. And you write, if current cost trends continue, DOD will soon pay more to support its retired military population and its current force. We're seeing this in public sectors all over the United States, federal government, mm-hmm. state government, local government, teachers, firefighters, police forces, essentially, Phil, what you're saying there in a much more diplomatic way than I'm about to put it. We're soon coming to a point where we'll be paying more people to not work than to work. What's the implication of that with budget decisions, with readiness decisions, and so on?
There are two implications. One is diagnostic and one is prescriptive. The diagnostic implication is that what we see is pressure from the accrued payments to retirees on all of the things we have to spend money on now. And so as the retirement expenditures increase, that squeezes out other things in the defense budget that we also think are really important. No one questions it's important to keep faith with retirees. They've earned their benefits. We have to honor that. But at some point, what we pay retirees puts pressure on what we can afford to spend for today's troops. And there's a risk that we might make our military unready by virtue of how much we spend on retirees. The prescriptive point is kind of the so what question. And not just so what, but so what now? The private sector and a lot of public institutions have moved away from the defined benefit type of pension like the military has to a defined contribution system that really limits the liability of the employer and leverages the market to drive the size of the retirement account and ultimately the return to the retiree. That's probably the big idea on the table that the commission and others will wrestle with, but it's not clear that can be made to work in the military context, which is so fundamentally different from the private sector, and also arguably where you need a better bargain to incentivize people to go into harm's way.
When the commission report comes out on Thursday, is there a part of it that you'll look to right away because you're curious to see what they've found, or do you have a sense that this that the work that they will put out will be similar to what we've seen in the past?
I'm going to read the whole report because I'm a nerdy think tanker, but I think you know, I'll look to the recommendations as a bellwether for how much risk the commission wanted to take this time. If they recommend modest changes to the pay structure or modest changes to the eligibility for retirement, then this will fit the pattern of past commissions. If there's really innovative thinking in there about how a defined contribution system could work or conversely, how a defined benefit system might be able to work better through different formulae or through different systems, then that would really be interesting. Certainly, if they tie it to broader thinking about the AVF, then that will be, I think, really provocative too.